Okay, it looks like we're ready to go. In this case, this is Derek Dwayne Cornejo. I apologize if I mispronounced the name. In the matter of Derek Dwayne Cornejo, may I have the entry of appearances, please?
Anthony Noble, registration number 33910. I'm the county council chair, the appellant, Derek Cornejo.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
Alan Irby, representing the Office of Attorney Regulation Council.
Thank you, counsel. This case is set for only 30 minutes. That means that each side has 15 minutes, as you're aware. You'll have to keep track of your own time, Mr. Noble. And whenever you're ready, sir, go ahead.
May it please the court, Anthony Noble for the appellant. This is an attorney discipline appeal in which Mr. Cornejo is challenging an 18-month suspension that was imposed by the hearing board. He's challenging it on two grounds. The first one is that the hearing board misapplied the aggravating and mitigating standards pursuant to the ABA standards.
Mr. Noble, can I ask you a favor? Can you lift that microphone up just slightly? I want to make sure I can hear you.
Well, the podium.
And the podium can go up too. There's a... Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, there are two issues in this appeal. The first is whether or not the hearing board misapplied the aggravating and mitigating factors pursuant to the ABA standards. And then the second issue is whether the ultimate sanction that was imposed, the 18 months of suspension, is unreasonable. Both issues reviewed de novo by this court, both the application of the aggravating and mitigating standards and the ultimate sanction that was imposed. And there are two guiding principles in reviewing a sanction imposed by the hearing board. The first is that the purpose of attorney discipline is to protect the public. It's not to punish the attorney. And then the second is that there has to be consistency in the application of the aggravating and mitigating factors, and there has to be consistency in the ultimate sanction that was imposed by the hearing board. It's important that there's consistency with the application in this case. It has to be consistent with the prior decisions of this court. And if you read the ABA standards, the introduction goes into the reason why they were created. And the ABA did a survey of what aggravating and mitigating factors that courts were applying in attorney discipline cases. And they were also looking at the presumptive sanctions that were being imposed. And they said that the reason for doing that was because there needed to be consistency not only amongst the states, but also within the individual states. The consistency ensures that there's fairness within the proceedings. So when you look at this case and the sanction that was imposed and compare it with the other cases that this case has published in attorney discipline cases, what you see is there is an inconsistency in this 18 months of suspension that was imposed in this case compared to similar cases in the past. One of the most distinguishing factors about this case is that there was absolutely no harm to any client or no potential harm to any clients, and that was what the hearing board found. What the hearing board did find, there was some intangible harm to the legal system and the legal profession. It didn't articulate what that harm was. But when you compare that harm to the legal system compared to, say, the harm that was found in the Olson case, and if you remember the Olson case that was published 2 years ago, in which the attorney in that case made misrepresentations to the federal court and filed and pursued frivolous claims, and the harm to the legal system of the courts in that case was that because of the frivolous claims that he was pursuing, and the misrepresentations that he was making, he incurred a number of hours of both the federal district court's time and the magistrate's time. So in this case, not only was there no harm to any client or no potential harm to any client, there was only this intangible harm to the legal system, but there was no actual harm to any court or to the profession. So that's one big distinguishing factor in this case that is not apparent in the other cases in which such a lengthy period of suspension has been imposed. One of the other distinguishing factors of this case is when you compare this with cases in which attorneys have been disciplined for practicing while suspended, The usual pattern in those cases is that the attorney is suspended, ordered suspended, and the attorney completely disregards the order, doesn't close down his practice, continues to represent clients, continues to enter court appearances, continues to file pleadings, and there's a complete disregard of the order of suspension, and he continues practicing law until he's finally caught and disciplinary proceedings are commenced. What happened in this case was that when Mr. Cornejo was ordered suspended, he immediately closed down his practice, he wound down his business, and he went for a period of 6 months where he had no employment, no involvement in the legal profession. And it wasn't until later on that he decided, he got together with another attorney and they devised this plan where he would provide consulting services and act as a paralegal or an investigator for her. She was an attorney that was inexperienced in criminal law, whereas Mr. Cornejo had substantial experience in criminal law. And her goal was to get out of her practice in family law and start taking criminal clients. So what happened was that the hearing board found that Mr. Cornejo didn't intend to disobey the order of suspension. The hearing board found that this was an ill-conceived plan. And what happened is that as a result of this consulting arrangement where Mr. Cornejo had more experience in criminal defense and DUI than the attorney that was supervising him, the hearing board found that there was violations of three rules of professional conduct relating to him negotiating the fee agreement, giving advice to clients, and not disclosing or misrepresenting himself as an attorney licensed to practice in this state. So the two big distinguishing factors in this case are the fact that no harm was really done to anybody, no clients, or the legal profession, or the courts. And in fact, two of the four clients for which he was found to have violated rules retained him when he was reinstated. Now, another distinguishing factor about this case is that Mr. Cornejo was reinstated before the complaint was filed and before the hearing board held the hearing on the rule violations. And he's now been reinstated for about, I think, over 2.5 years. So he's been in practice during the proceedings in before the hearing board. And then when this appeal was filed, the hearing board granted a stay of the suspension and ordered that he be monitored by a practice monitor. So one of the considerations that the court has to take into account when determining whether or not the sanction is reasonable is the harm to the public. And what Mr. Cornejo has demonstrated is that in the past 2.5 years while he's been reinstated, there has been no harm to the public, no harm to any clients. So this case has many more mitigating factors than other cases in which this court has either imposed or affirmed this length of suspension for similar violations. So the 18-month suspension here, considering that there was no harm to any clients, no harm to the legal system, no harm to the legal profession, seems excessive, especially in relation to the needs of the public, where the needs of the public, you know, seem to be addressed by his supervision while his suspension is staying. So I'd ask the court to find that the 18-month suspension is unreasonable for that basis.
Are you suggesting there'll be no period of suspension?
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of options for this court that I've laid out in the opening brief from reviewing prior decisions of this court. So one would be a reprimand, which in some very rare circumstances is imposed for practicing while suspended. And I've cited two examples in which a reprimand was given for practicing while suspended. The other option that the court would have would be to continue the stay of the suspension and put Mr. Cornejo on probation. And he's eligible for probation because is adequately being supervised. He's been supervised now for 6 or 7 months since this appeal was filed. There's been no rule violations, no new complaints, and he's not causing any harm or any danger to the public. While he's being supervised, there have been no complaints regarding his representation. And this isn't a case that warrants disbarment, so he meets the eligibility criteria for probation. So the one thing that I did suggest in the opening brief, that a period of probation would be appropriate in this case, considering that there's no danger to the public, which is the ultimate goal of the sanction imposed. So I would be asking the court to suspend the 18 months period of suspension and grant probation for a period that the court determines is appropriate. Now, the other question here is whether or not the hearing board misapplied the aggravating and mitigating factors. And I've given the court four instances in which there was an error made in the application of the factors. The court, the first error is the application of the pattern of misconduct standard that was found by the hearing board. If you look at the cases that this court has published, that has consistently been applied to where there's been a misconduct in a separate case that occurred around the same time as the misconduct in the current case. And the Olson case is a perfect example of how that pattern of misconduct aggravator works. In Olson, there was a similar finding that it was a single violation of three distinct rules. And it wasn't that that pattern that the court referred to as a pattern that formed the aggravating factor under the pattern of misconduct. It was the fact that Olson had a separate case in which he had been disciplined that formed the pattern. And so that's a consistent ruling from this court, that the pattern involves another case in which discipline has been imposed around the same time. It's distinct from a prior disciplinary action because it occurs around the same time, and it's distinct from multiple offenses because multiple offenses are the number of claims within one particular case. So the hearing board in this case misapplied that ABA standard and applied average weight to that aggravating factor, whereas no weight should have been given to that factor. The other factor is the other aggravating factor that the hearing board found was the length of time that Mr. Cornejo has been in practice. If you read all of the opinions from this court on that particular factor, there's only one case in which the court explains when that is applied, and that factor is applied when the experience would or would not have contributed to the misconduct in this case. So I think Olson is another good example of the correct application of that factor, because in Olson, he was making misrepresentations to the court, and he was filing frivolous claims and pursuing frivolous claims. So the court also found he had substantial experience of litigation. So his knowledge of litigation, his experience of litigation, he should have been able to identify what was and was not a frivolous claim. So in that case, the court correctly applied that aggravating factor because his experience should have prevented this misconduct from happening. Whereas in Mr. Cornejo's case, the misconduct is disobeying an order of suspension. And even an inexperienced attorney would know whether or not the order is being disregarded.
Mr. Noble, I know you have a brief time. Factually, I had one question and I couldn't locate it. It appears Mr. Cornejo was suspended for 9 months and that was stayed. That stay was lifted, but for what reason was the stay lifted?
I think he failed monitored sobriety in that previous case, which is no longer an issue here. So if that's a consideration about whether or not probation is appropriate here, you know, that's certainly not an issue here, and there's no record of that being a concern by the hearing board in this case. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Certainly.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The question in this case is what is the appropriate sanction when a suspended lawyer with a significant history of discipline knowingly violates this court's order of disciplinary suspension on four separate occasions and does so for his own financial gain. This court has held over and over again that practicing while suspended is a serious violation of the rules of professional conduct.
Well, counsel, can you stop it and just explain how this was knowingly? You know, it didn't, the wasn't the finding that it was ill-conceived, but perhaps not to the level of knowingly that you just suggested.
Sure. I think the respondent overemphasizes the hearing board's statements that he somehow crossed a line into the unauthorized practice, or he intended to comply with the court's order. But the hearing board found explicitly that his mental state under the ABA standards was knowing. That means he knew he was suspended. He knew he was practicing law in violation of this order of suspension. And not only that, but he acted dishonestly. He violated Rule 8.4C, and he also acted with a dishonest or selfish motive under the mitigating and aggravating factors. So absolutely, I think the conduct here is knowing, and the hearing board made that clear.
How do you explain the use of the word ill-conceived? I mean, how would you read that as?
Well, what happened here is the respondent is suspended. He complies with his order of suspension for about 6 months. And then he hatches this scheme with another attorney named Leila Uribar. They're going to go into a consulting arrangement where he is to recruit clients. What happens is he ends up practicing law on his own. He's sneaking around behind Leila Uribar's back. He's recruiting clients. He's signing up clients on his own fee agreement. He's handing out his own business card, which identifies himself as a lawyer. And he's giving legal advice outside of the presence, sometimes in the presence. And so the question of whether he knowingly violated the court order, I think, is clear. He absolutely did. I hope I'm answering your question.
Thank you.
The enforcement of this court's disciplinary orders is critical to promote respect for the court, to protect the integrity of the disciplinary system, and the legal system as a whole. And the 18-month suspension imposed in this case is directly related to the conduct at issue. It's not manifestly excessive, and it's reasonable. This court should affirm. Now, the respondent makes much of the hearing board's finding that there was no harm to any client in this case. But to focus too much on the harm to the clients misses the point, because the harm in a case like this is to the system. A lawyer who practices while suspended is rarely going to cause harm to a client, but the harm is to the system. And the hearing board recognizes this, and it said in its opinion, the respondent's conduct brings the profession into disrepute. And this point about harm to the system is especially true when a lawyer violates an order of disciplinary suspension, as opposed to an order of administrative suspension. Keep in mind, the respondent's suspension was disciplinary. The point is, the public needs to know that when a lawyer practices while suspended, there will be serious consequences. Because if there are no consequences, then there's no recourse against a lawyer who chooses to violate or to ignore this court's orders. And that strikes at the very heart of the regulatory system. This court has instructed hearing boards exactly what they need to do where imposing a sanction in a disciplinary case. They are to look at the ABA standards, the aggravating and mitigating factors, and they can consider this court's case law, although they're not bound by any one case because the facts are always different. The hearing board in this case did exactly what it was supposed to do in reaching the appropriate sanction. It started with ABA standard 6.22. Suspension is appropriate when a lawyer knowingly violates a court order or rule, and there's injury or potential injury. Look at ABA standard 7.2. Suspension is appropriate when a lawyer violates a duty owed to a profession. And as I explained, he examined the lawyer's mental state under the ABA standards and found it explicitly to be known. And then the hearing board turned to the aggravating and mitigating factors. And this is where there's coming up. And I'll point out that by appealing these aggravating and mitigating factors, the respondent is essentially asking this court to reweigh the evidence, to re-examine the facts found by the hearing board. This court should decline to do so. He first says the hearing board should not have found a pattern of misconduct because there's no separate discipline imposed in a different case. That's simply not a requirement under the standards or under the case law.
What about counsel's comparison with the Olson case? misrepresentation there.
As far as...
Yeah, that didn't occur here, did it?
I'm sorry, as far as misrepresentation?
Yeah, misrepresentation to the court. Remind me what the sanction was in Olson.
Olson was a public censure. Now, the hearing board imposed a 6-month suspension. This court imposed a public censure. The respondent in this case was absolutely dishonest. He knowingly violated a court order under Rule 3.4c. He violated Rule 8.4c regarding dishonesty. And so the way I would compare this case to Olson is that here you have a lawyer who is going out knowingly violating an order of disciplinary suspension. Again, the public cannot come away from this case with the impression that a lawyer can walk away from continuing to practice after being suspended with a slap on your wrist. It simply can't. Olson's conduct was found to be negligent, not relevant. And that was the difference between a suspension and a public censure. And that's the holding of Olson, that's also the holding of People versus Kane. And that's stated in UBA standards as well. Excuse me. As for pattern misconduct, this court can look to a couple of prior practicing while suspended cases, People versus Ross and People versus Carl, where this court found a pattern of misconduct, and there was no separate discipline imposed in any other case. In one of those cases, the lawyer continues to practice after being suspended, makes a couple of court appearances, and then does a trial. The hearing board, this is the Ross case, the hearing board found a pattern of misconduct, and this court affirmed. The Carl case was similar. We found it here in several court proceedings. There was a this court affirmed. And there's no separate discipline in the lawyer or case, any other case. Respondent also tries to confuse the issues a little bit by talking about distinct violations of the rules of professional conduct versus a single violation of the rules of professional conduct. The hearing board here did find one violation of each rule. That's irrelevant to the fact, to the issue of whether there's a pattern, because the issue there is about the conduct. It's a pattern of conduct. It's not a pattern of rule violations. The respondent makes argues the court should not consider his substantial experience as an aggravating factor. In Hickox, this court did state that a lawyer who engaged in domestic violence, the substantial experience would not have made that conduct more or less likely. The lawyer in Hickox twisted his girlfriend's arm behind her back, pushed her up the stairs in their own home. That has nothing to do with the practice of law, although it does adversely reflect on his fitness as a lawyer. The conduct in this case is the practice of law. It has everything to do with the practice of law. After he's suspended, the respondent's experience should have taught him, one, what the practice of law is, and therefore what he can and cannot do, and two, the importance of obeying court orders. He had been a lawyer for about 14 years at the time he was suspended, and I don't think the respondent's arguing that that's not substantial experience. But it should absolutely be considered an aggravating factor in this case. Again, there are practicing law suspended cases where the court does apply this factor. People versus Ross and People versus Kane. The hearing board, one was a 20-year lawyer, one was a 35-year lawyer. The hearing boards applied the aggravating factor of substantial experience, and this court affirmed. The respondent next argues, his character witness testimony should have been given greater weight. First, he's arguing that the hearing board erred by only allowing him to call 3 character witnesses. What happened was, right before the trial of this case, the respondent disclosed untimely 9 or 10 character witnesses. The people filed a motion to limit that testimony to 3. And the hearing board granted that motion in a well-reasoned opinion. I found all these people, all these witnesses, were former clients. They were all going to testify to essentially the same thing. The respondent did a good job on their cases. So it was cumulative. They were also only disclosed. And so consistent with People versus Morley, which holds that a respondent in a disciplinary case doesn't have the right to call any and all witnesses he chooses, the court limited the witnesses to 3. And it has broad discretion to do that. Then the hearing board, consistent with its duty under Attorney F, listened to the character testimony, gave it the weight it deemed appropriate. The hearing board stated in his opinion that the clients all said Mr. Cornejo did a great job on their cases. He was honest and forthright. He was communicative. He was diligent.
but they did not know about his discipline. They didn't know about his prior discipline. They didn't even know, it appears from the record, about this current case. And so it's incredible that a respondent in a disciplinary case would call character witnesses who didn't even know what they were there testifying about. And so the hearing board, consistent with its duty, gave that fact, which came out on cross-examination, the way it felt appropriate, as is its prerogative. The respondent next argues the court should have considered his initial and substantial compliance with the order of suspension. And he points to cases where lawyers are suspended and they keep right on practicing without winding down. First of all, initial and substantial compliance with the order is not a mitigating factor under the ABA standards. The hearing board was not required to consider it. Of course, they were aware of this fact. He closed down his practice. He managed to not practice law for about 6 months. And they may have taken that into account, but it's not a mitigating factor. More importantly, the fact that he closed down his practice and then only later hatches this scheme, again, labeling the waybar, to get back into the practice of law, shows the knowing nature of his misconduct and also the dishonest nature of his misconduct. He knows he's a suspended lawyer. He knows he's not allowed to practice law, and he does it anyway. And then again, not only that, he acts dishonestly, and he gives these clients the impression he's a licensed lawyer. I can point out that responding to People versus Kane, another practicing law suspended case, apparently made it about 4 years after he was suspended before he represented a client, and the hearing board, the court, didn't give him any credit for that. It's just not a mitigating factor. And the respondent talks about the case law. He says this case is not consistent with this court's prior case law. The parties have cited a couple of public century cases. These two public century cases, People versus Kane and People versus Pittum, have unique circumstances that make them public century cases. It comes down to the respondent's mental state, which was not explicitly found to be knowing in those cases, and it comes down to the facts of each case. In Kane, the respondent represents a father and a son, drafts some warranty deeds and deeds of trust in a promissory note. Kane had already been out of the practice of law for 8 years at the time of the disciplinary case, and so the court found an additional period of suspension unnecessary. Likewise, Pittum represented a client in one court appearance after having tried to arrange substitute counsel. Substitute counsel couldn't make it. The client asked Pittum to appear for him. Pittum agreed. There was no harm to the client, and there was no benefit for the lawyer.
Let me ask you this. In light of the findings by the board that his plans were ill-conceived, he desired to comply with the suspension order but crossed the line, yet he did not set out to practice law on his own, et cetera, et cetera. Basically the last page of the order. In light of that, why wasn't probation considered?
Again, the court needs to focus not on harm to the clients. Probation is appropriate when the public can be protected. There will be no harm to the clients because there are monitoring conditions. The court needs to consider the harm to the disciplinary system. Mr. Cornegaro was suspended for 9 months. He violated that order of suspension. Now, to place him on probation is going to give the public the impression that this system, the court regulatory system, is protecting its own. It's important that he now be suspended. And as can be, there are several suspension level cases cited in the briefs. This case is directly in line with those cases. The cases range from 90 days, which is sort of their extenuating circumstances in the Dieters case, where 90 days is imposed, all the way up to 3 years.
Mr. Ogle, you're about to run out of time. Let me just interject, if I may. If we were to affirm, do you think we should do so without opinion, or is there something about which you think the legal community really requires our guidance in this instance?
If there is an opinion, Your Honor, I think that the primary purpose would be to stress the importance of obedience to court orders, especially for a lawyer who's been disciplined. But no, I don't believe that there's any need for an opinion in this case. With that, I think the hearing board's opinion is is reasonable, that this has been imposed is not excessive, and I ask that this court affirm.
All right, thank you. Mr. Miller, I think you have a little bit of time.
I'd like to first address just this first question about whether an opinion is needed. I did extensive research on these aggravating and mitigating factors, reviewing every published opinion from this court, and then prior to filing the reply brief, trying to review every published opinion from every other court and every state on these particular factors. And the factors were being applied, you can see that in the opinion, but what we couldn't find out was why they were being applied. You know, where is the pattern of misconduct under this aggravating factor? You know, when is substantial experience of employment an aggravating factor? So the only case I could find on that issue was the Hickox case from this court, which kind of indicated in one sentence that it has to be somehow related to the misconduct. And then on the pattern of misconduct, I cited the case in the Oregon Supreme Court, which they acknowledged that they have consistently applied that aggravating factor where there's misconduct in a separate case that occurred around the same time. So I think that the published opinion is required to clarify, you know, when do factors amount to aggravating factors and mitigating factors, rather than just applying them in this case. I think that the hearing board needs some guidance on you know, what is the pattern of misconduct, when is substantial experience of practice relevant. So I'd ask the court to issue a published opinion and to suspend stay the suspension and current probation.
Any questions? All right, thank you very much, Mr. Noble.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Ellis. This case will stand submitted. We're going to take a recess for about 15 minutes before we do the next case. So we'll be in recess for 15 minutes.